On Monday, I will commence the process set out under our Referendum Act, and I will go to Parliament and propose that the British people decide our future in Europe through an in-out referendum on Thursday, the 23rd of June. The choice is in your hands.
Welcome to this IBA Global Insight podcast. 10 years ago, the UK voted to leave the EU in a referendum called by then UK Prime Minister David Cameron, heard addressing the British people at the start of this podcast. This led to a sustained period of upheaval and uncertainty. The UK government has recently sought to reset its relationship with the EU and foster closer collaboration, which the EU leadership has in principle supported. Here's Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission.
Europe, and in particular the UK, should come closer on security, on economy, on defending our democracies. 10 years from Brexit, our futures are as bound as ever.
However, a decade on from the vote, Brexit continues to present challenges across the board. Benjamin Martil, Associate Fellow in the UK in the World programme at think tank Chatham House, takes stock of where the UK is on security and defence.
Is the UK more secure now? Absolutely not. We've seen a return of war on the European continent. Europe itself is fragmented, but also torn between essentially competing powers in the international system whose democratic credentials are very, very much challenged and who in many cases have very aggressive positions towards the European Union, obviously some more so than others. But I think, for Europe, being caught between Putin's Russia and Trump's United States is a very, very difficult situation to be in. It's very difficult for the special relationship because Trump doesn't seem to believe in special relationships. Of course, Britain's still outside of the EU, and so we're not as influential there, really, as in any sense as we would have been as a member. And so this is really fundamentally torn asunder kind of the main relationships that the UK used to pride itself on having. But more importantly, I think Britain's role in the world was never just about, at least since the end of the Second World War, it's never just been about having these relationships. It's about being able to be useful to the other side in Washington or in Brussels. And that's something I think is really difficult. So in the greater levels of insecurity, absolutely. Britain and European partners in many ways lack some of the capabilities that you think they would be able to generate with their sort of combined economic weight. They have very significant threats and in a sense are dealing with multiple wars that they're implicated in various different ways at the same time. It's not, where does Britain's one serviceable frigate go when you're fighting two wars is a really important question. And this is at a time where we realize in a sense that, the forms of ideological conflict are back, that some of the relationships that we fundamentally depended on are fraying, and that Britain is, if it ever was, not quite as popular in other parts of the world as it thought it was. So I think it's a worrying time, and I think the reset is very, very important, actually. I mean, having the Security and Defence Partnership with the EU has allowed officials on both sides to start talking to each other. It's allowed for conversations on UK potential accession to some pretty significant EU initiatives. And I think it hasn't come about initially, but I think you'll see movement on that in the next few years. It's also a bit of a platform to discuss other alternatives. And outside of the relationship with the EU, of course, you've seen the reemergence of this kind of E3 cooperation, Britain, France and Germany. At the same time, I think given the way that the EU's interests are structured, the last thing they want is somebody who wants to be further integrated into areas of policymaking and the single market whilst maintaining the red line. And then you get this really interesting dynamic where I think for the current government, they think, look, we're really good Europeans. We're saying that we can maybe make a contribution here that's in everyone's best interest. And then, of course, that's absolutely rebuffed on the same grounds that Theresa May was rebuffed when he said, well, absolutely not. We're not going to give you anything that looks like sector by sector access to different EU policy areas. And so that's something that is very difficult to see where you go with that, but very easy to see why the current government might have felt it would get a little bit more out of the reset.
Sarah Andrew, Legal and Campaign Director at non-profit Avaaz, discusses how UK and EU regulation of the tech sector has diverged since Brexit.
Where the big divergence has come, and it is a big divergence, is in the approach to legal but harmful. And what you'll see there is the EU deciding to take on a kind of holistic duty of care approach to the providers of online services. That's the platforms, but it's also increasingly AI developers. And they are looking to introduce systems of assessment of harm and mitigation of harm. And they are backing those up pretty forcefully with codes of practice, which, if you don't adhere to them, affect your fines. And set against that systemic approach, so we're going to look at the system and the way the system amplifies harm, creates addiction, allows harmful, non-consensual intimate imagery to produce, all of these things which are on the verge of illegal but not clearly defined as such are caught within that duty of care framework. Whereas the approach that the UK took, which does make some sense if you know the history of where regulation came from, and I'll confess I am an ex-Ofcom regulator, that approach is much more focused on content. And still, it's almost like it's an updated way of looking at TV broadcast. You know, what is the content? How do we capture the harms that the content are doing?
Sarah discusses what this divergence means in the context of the recently enacted UK Online Safety Act.
So what you're seeing is much less systemic, and I would say is overly focused on material which is frankly already illegal. So if something's already illegal, there are already ways to prevent the damage that that content is doing. And my big disappointment was that the UK government, and this is going back beyond the current administration, they didn't take on the arguments that we needed to move to the concept of tech as a product. It's not just a service, it's a product. And where products cause harm, there should be a liability framework. And we're still struggling with that. You see the UK trying to backfill where the gaps are. So it's just, you know, trying to backfill with a ban on kids accessing certain technology services rather than the EU approach, which is these technology services must have safeguards, must be designed with children in mind. And if you don't design them like that, you must withdraw them from the market.
Catherine Barnard, Professor of EU Law at the University of Cambridge, explains how Brexit has affected the rule of law in the UK, including the court system. She highlights the UK's position as it attempts to further align with EU law.
In respect to the rule of law in the UK, what was really striking in the run-up to the referendum was just how little thought had been given to the impact of a Brexit vote on the whole UK legal system. And essentially what happened, and perhaps the most genius of the piece of legislation, was the European Union Withdrawal Act 2018. And that piece of legislation was essentially preparing the UK statute book for a no-deal Brexit in the worst-case scenario, or a deal Brexit in some form. And essentially what it did was to take a screenshot of all EU legislation which had been on the UK statute book to ensure that it continued the day after Brexit Day, even if we left the EU without a deal. And that piece of legislation has really stood the test of time. It has been tremendously successful. So successful, I think, that it's become almost part of the furniture of the UK legal system. And by that I mean, courts don't refer to the 2018 Act except in fairly exceptional cases. And they just listen to its instruction, which is broadly speaking business as usual, and carry on applying pre-Brexit EU legislation in the UK so long as that's applicable. The long the short of it is, large swathes of EU law are still on the statute book. The courts are applying them, and there is actually remarkable continuity between the way the courts apply the law today with how they would have applied it pre-Brexit, except in areas like free movement where the law has obviously changed. But in the area of workers' rights, for example, the part-time work regulations, the fixed-term work regulations, these are all retained EU law, and the courts are just carrying on applying them as they did pre-Brexit. So there is remarkable continuity. And of course, now the UK wants to get closer to the EU and is negotiating agreements with the EU as we speak, covering four areas. SPS, which is sanitary, phytosanitary, which is essentially a veterinary agreement. Secondly, energy cooperation. Thirdly, emissions trading. And fourthly, youth mobility. Now, of those, the SPS agreement in particular will require quite a lot of legislation, because while the UK has not departed significantly from EU rules, of course, the EU has not stood still since 2020, and the EU has been legislating. We will have to catch up with all of that legislation, and we'll also have to agree to what's called dynamic alignment. And that means not just catching up, but also keeping up to date with the latest EU rules. Now, the position we will be in if we sign the SPS agreement is that we will be rule takers, not rule makers. We'll be in the same position as Norway and Switzerland, where they have decided it's in their national interest to carry on aligning with the latest EU rules, even though they have very little say in the content of those rules.
Catherine comments on the suggestions made by some UK lawmakers that the country should leave the European Convention on Human Rights.
This has very serious implications for the current deal under which the UK trades with the EU, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, because that is underpinned by our continued membership of the European Convention. So it's likely that the Trade and Cooperation Agreement would be suspended, possibly terminated, which essentially takes us back to a no-deal Brexit. It will also have serious implications for the Good Friday Agreement, which will therefore also have effects on the withdrawal agreement, the other main treaty by which we left the European Union. It will also have serious implications for our reputation on the global stage.
Official figures indicate that in 2025, UK exports to the EU were down by 14% and imports had decreased by 10% compared to 2019. And in terms of UK goods export volumes to the EU, 2025 was one of the worst years this century. Here, Kirsten Matthias, Director, International Affairs at Trade Association UK Finance, draws on a recent report by her organisation to explain how the UK and the EU could work together to stimulate future growth.
The main argument we're making in the report is that the UK and the EU are two deeply interconnected economies. We share the same regulatory DNA. We face the same global challenges. And fundamentally, we believe we can achieve better outcomes when we cooperate in a purposeful way. So the question for us is not whether we should work together, but how we should work together. And the political conditions to answer that question ambitiously are better than at any point really since the vote in 2016. So that's the argument. What we're proposing is a three-stage roadmap where we have short-term, medium-term, and long-term proposals for how we can strengthen the relationship. And the idea is that we would build up political capital really over time. So in the short term, we're proposing a number of practical steps that we think are deliverable now. They're around embedding financial services in the annual UK-EU Leaders Summit agenda. So the new annual moment where we can set the agenda from a political perspective. We then think that it would be worthwhile to establish task and finish working groups under the EU-UK forum on things such as transaction reporting, where both jurisdictions are reforming the regime simultaneously, on digital assets, consolidated tape. Again, lots of activity happening in both jurisdictions at the same time with very similar objectives. We have also, of course, looked again at the much discussed CCP equivalent equivalence, where we think really there is no more need for that to be a time-limited decision. Similar arguments apply to the data adequacy decision, which is also currently set to run out in 2031. So those are the ideas in the short term. In the medium term, we're talking about a services mobility agreement. So that could be modeled on what is currently in place between the UK and Switzerland already to reduce frictions for skilled professionals moving between both jurisdictions. We return to equivalence, where we're asking for a CRR equivalence decision to remove operational frictions between the UK and the EU, where, for instance, currently EU banks are treating UK residential property as unfortunately worthless collateral from a capital perspective. So it's a kind of direct example where the state of the relationship negatively impacts the EU economy. And we're also thinking about innovative ways of collaborating, given that that is such a big focus when it comes to strengthening competitiveness of the industry across the world, really, and the use of regulatory sandboxes and innovation labs. And then finally, in the long term, our proposal is around a bespoke UK-EU financial services agreement modelled on the outcomes-based mutual recognition principles that we have seen in the Bern financial services agreement. And then ultimately to actually think about this from a pan-European perspective and connecting the EU not just with the UK, but potentially also with Switzerland and others.